news, reviews, commentary, not just another podcast.
Are you on your Big Ball Podcast?
Calm down. There's nothing to worry about. We have no choice but to ask them for help. However, that doesn't mean I'll fall victim to their ow in the head.
Now here comes your host, Kyle Abear, and all the world see.
Welcome to the Big Ball Broadcast, episode 98, with all the geeky news you can use, part of thegeekmedia.com, filling your brains with delectable ear candy from the land of movies, TV, animation, games, comics, and more. From the West Coast, this is Kyle Abear. I'm an anime and video game voice actor.
And your co-host on the East Coast, Otherworld Steve. I'm a musician. I'm going to give a little plug here. Check out eberecords.com or go to myspace.com/perimeterofthevoid. And I'm also an up-and-coming author.
And on this here episode, you will hear the following content. A major update involving Watchmen, because sure enough, we don't broadcast on a live daily basis. And like this... The latest happenings happened like a day or two after we posted the last episode. But anyway, major update on that, as well as the next live-action Cowboy Bebop movie. We're talking about Black Widow weaving a spell for Iron Man 2. Sam Jackson and Nick Fury, not gonna happen? What's up with that? What do Jackie Chan and Mr. Miyagi have in common? Star Wars the Musical. Oh my. Clone Wars coming to DVD, inevitable of course, and when can you get your hands on that brand spanking new Nintendo handheld console, the DSi? Gore in video games, is it what gamers really crave? Circuit City closing more stores, this time, all of them! Facebook has killed the Burger King app we talked about on the last show. What's up with that? National Safety Council wants cell phones banned, period. That's right, even hands-free and Bluetooth for anybody behind the wheel. We're going to discuss that one. Downloads coming to YouTube and our top 10 list, the worst video games based on movies. Coming up, we've got that plus quick hits and your emails and MP3 comments coming up on the Big Ball Broadcast.
You hear him on anime and video games, and he could be coming to your town. Here's a list of appearances to meet Kyle Abear in person. And trust me, it's no big deal. February 6th through 8th, IkiCon in Austin, Texas. March 27th through 29th, Anime Land Wasabi in Denver. Anime Detour, April 3rd through 5th at St. Paul, Minnesota. Louisianime at Baton Rouge, Louisiana, May 8th through 10th. Animazement, Durham, North Carolina, May 22nd through 24th. ACON in Dallas, Texas, May 29th through 31st. And Anime Next, June 12th through 14th in Somerset, New Jersey. Keep in mind, more conventions will be listed. And for the latest updates, make sure and go to KyleAbear.com. Go see Kyle at one of these conventions and give him all your money, because he's broke. Ah, just kidding. Yeah, not really.
Welcome back. This is the Big Ball Broadcast, episode 98. What is up, Mr. Steve?
Not a lot. I've been waiting last couple of weeks to go check out a motorbike, a motorcycle, if you will. Bastard didn't call me today to go check it out, so I'm a little bummed. Kind of amped to get the motorcycle, get it home, and do the whole motorcycle safety course and get my permit and my license and get it registered and the whole nine. So hopefully, by the time we record our next podcast, I'll have some brighter news regarding that.
And on my end, work is still almost non-existent. Man, this economy is just hitting everybody. We're going to talk about this with the whole Circuit City thing. But yeah, work has been really, really light on my end. And in case you were under a rock, we got a new president this week. It's really interesting because I keep on getting conflicting stories about whether or not he gets to keep his crackberry, because he's a big blackberry addict. And that becomes a kind of a security risk, I suppose.
It does. I think they found a happy medium with a different version of a blackberry. But again, yeah, there are a bunch of conflicting reports out there. I work for a nonprofit state-funded organization, and I just celebrated my 10th anniversary. I always said, well, you know, it's a job, it's a gig, it's something to do until something better comes along. And yeah, given the state of the economy, I'm really glad that what I do is considered essential services. So for the time being anyway, I don't have to worry about a layoff.
I, however, am far from essential. The entertainment industry, although one might argue that it's essential because you need escape. Yeah, man, the cuts are going crazy left and right.
But, you know, I'm assuming the video game market has to be somewhat stable, you know, especially after the Black Friday postings, especially from Nintendo, the holiday postings from Nintendo, everything from Nintendo. Nintendo says that their 99% market share is what's keeping the industry going strong, so hopefully you can get to do some VO work on some Nintendo games and keep riding that wave.
Oh, certainly. And talking to even more in the video game department, mobile video games. We're talking like iPhone apps and such. We're going to talk about this in the quick hits coming up. But this industry has just come out of left field and is booming right now.
It is. And hopefully the big studios acknowledge that, you know, much like Konami did. We talked a few episodes back about Konami bringing some big titles to the small platform. I'm hoping for your sake anyway, some of the big game developers take this platform very seriously and bring on, you know, top-notch talent to voice those characters.
And that is the whole conundrum of the Screen Actors Guild wanting to strike over the new media agreement. The whole new media is, of course, internet and mobile gaming devices and platforms, and the fact that SAG is saying there's no structure for residuals, and then AFTRA went ahead and said, oh, yes, we're gonna put this agreement in place. So now you've got a lot of members that are in SAG and AFTRA, and like, what are they going to do? They're going to strike against themselves, you know, especially in this economy. Are you really going to walk a picket line when you really need to pay the bills?
Yeah, a strike this year would seem absolutely frivolous. I don't think the networks and the studios are going to fight real hard in terms of negotiating fees because, you know, what happened the last time there was a big strike? We get a lot of reality television, and I'm sure there's enough reality television producers out there just chomping at the bit, waiting to saturate our network television with it. So, again, just a really, really bad idea right now, given the state of the economy.
Definitely. I mean, these contracts come up for renewal every few years. Just like, bide your time, guys. We can make it happen later. It's just a bad time, bad circumstances for all, but SAG is trying to get authorization for a strike, and it's got to get a majority of its membership to say yes to a vote on that. So it's not 100% in as of this podcast, but who knows? What I think will happen is, as far as video games go and any other contract that's not new media, a lot of producers are probably just going to say, you know, screw SAG, we're going to go over to AFTRA because they're easier to work with. And again, a lot of SAG members are in AFTRA.
What can you do? I guess hope the majority of your peers feel the same way you do.
Yeah, I don't know. I've seen very heartfelt, passionate arguments for both. For me, you got to pick your battles. You don't want to piss away the chance to get residuals on things. But again, these contract negotiations happen. It's not like it's locked in for eternity. You know, we'll figure this out. Yeah, the networks are starting to make money on the internet. We're starting to see radio and TV move towards the internet because everyone is on the internet. We're an online generation. It's just nothing that's going to get ironed out overnight.
Yeah, there's a big difference between spending your disposable income on entertainment and having to absolutely pay your bills and put the food on the table. So you know, here's hoping those people who are in charge and pull the strings and make those decisions understand that for the majority of the people working in SAG and AFTRA, you're not all Ben Affleck and Jennifer Aniston, and you know, you got people who are just getting by to pay their bills. So
yeah, the level of celebrities, the Tom Hanks and all that. I mean, there are some big names out there who are against the whole strike idea, but yeah, most of the membership in these unions are not big booking actors or celebrities. But before we go off on too much of a tangent, let's come back around to our inbox, where you can leave your feedback and MP3 comments. We've actually got a few to play today. This is
You've Got Mail.
Let's start off at thebigballbroadcast@gmail.com. That is the email address you need to know if you'd like to send us your feedback or submit a story. First one comes from Lewis in Australia, who I believe has written us before, and he has a question for you, Steve. He says, I checked out Perimeter of the Void on MySpace, and I was pretty surprised. It reminded me of some kind of mix between King Crimson vocals and what would be a pseudo-Opeth band. Really freaking cool. Who did you guys take influence from? Thanks very much, and keep the podcast coming.
Well, when we first started initially, and we were drafting some of the primary tracks, the things that we were listening to at the time that I think really heavily influenced the entire album, a lot of early Britney Spears, some mid-era Michael Jackson, some early New Kids on the Block, A little Barry White. You know, can't forget to give the props to Barry White. So I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad you found it interesting. And that's definitely where we're coming from as artists. That's the stuff that we crank up in our cars when we're cruising around town.
Oh, that's nice. And I hope on your next album, the Jonas Brothers has a significant influence.
I was thinking more of like the Nelson vein and maybe even some... Oh, what's her name? I love her to death. I have all her albums, but I can't remember her name right now. Oh, Miley Cyrus.
Ah, yeah. You got to have some Hannah Montana there.
Definitely some Hannah Montana. I think you're going to hear the next album some very heavily influenced tracks from Hannah Montana.
All right. So is there a real answer?
Yeah, it's not real. No, okay, seriously. What I really like about Perimeter of the Void is the individuals primarily responsible for bringing the tracks together are me and my brother-in-law. And while we do share some common ground with some acts like early Metallica, early Megadeth, we are very varied, like, from that point on. I grew up listening to a lot of punk, Sex Pistols, Clash, with some hardcore like Minor Threat. Agent Orange, Dead Milkmen, definitely like my favorites. The Misfits, big influence on me with the whole horror movie punk stuff. Some Ramones. My brother-in-law, on the other hand, he gets into a lot of the digital music. Tool is a big influence for him. Maynard is definitely a huge influence in a lot of his styles, both musically and vocally. And Opeth, he listens to Opeth. He actually has some Opeth tracks over on his MySpace page. So it was great for us to come together, and there was no arguments involved. It was I put on the table what I thought was interesting, he put on the table what he thought was interesting, and we kind of just symbolically put it in a blender and poured it out, and that's what you hear with Perimeter of the Void. We have a wonderful working relationship, and we're actually going to be starting, I believe, next week on the second album, as well as some of the soundtrack stuff for the Magnum Farce movie, which I know you've all heard the promo for on the podcast, and we're hoping to cut a brand new single and kind of rush it out there to kind of see how people feel about us taking kind of a new direction with Perimeter of the Void. So hopefully within the next couple of weeks, we can debut a brand new single.
There you go. I can throw in that even though I'm not in the band, I also like Opeth a lot. They're kind of a musical blender. They've got a lot of things going on. They've got progressive. They've got jazz. They've got metal. They've got a little bit of everything. But you guys, the Perimeter sound is totally unique. It doesn't really make me think of Opeth, per se, because it's a little more of a digital influence and a little more electronica blended in and world music, but that's a great thing about a band that you do have a hard time trying to draw some sort of comparison to.
And what was really interesting with us was the melding of the acoustics with the distorted guitar. The first song, Cold Steel, which has this wonderful narration from some no-name VO actor, that was kind of in a commercial vein, try to hook people from the beginning of the commercial stuff. But then it kind of ping-pongs back and forth with a lot of acoustic elements, and then we have songs that are really heavy with a lot of the distorted guitar. There is a lot of digital influence in Perimeter of the Void, but the guitar stuff, that's all real. That we have Spanish acoustic with nylon strings, 12-string acoustic, some beefy electric guitars. I played both my acoustic and my electric bass in the tracks. So we try to keep it mixed up. And I think the next album, you're going to kind of see the same thing with it being mixed up, where it's going to be kind of hard to put your finger on what genre we are exactly. But, you know, we're having a blast doing it. And we can only hope that other people enjoy it as much or even half as much as we do.
If you guys want to check out the album, it's only like, what, $2 to download?
$2 for the digital download. 14 tracks, MP3, 256kb quality. For $5, you can get the physical CD and the download. And what's neat about that is when you go over to the shop page on eburecords.com, if you buy the physical CD, you get to download the digital album immediately. There's no waiting. There's no delay. As soon as you finish the checkout, boom, download link. So, you know, check it out. I think the price is right.
eburecords.com for Perimeter of the Void. Let's move on to an MP3 comment from Kerbifer.
Hey Kyle and Steve, this is Kerbifer. So recently I went back and watched a few episodes of the Great Saiyaman arc from Dragon Ball Z. And by the way, Kyle, you're everywhere. Not even just Saiyaman, you are everywhere. Every 2 seconds I'm hearing your voice pop up from like random people. It's hysterical. Anyway, so I realized when I went back and watched these episodes that this is actually one of my favorite parts of the entire series, where Gohan goes to high school and is completely different from the rest of the show. But why is it that Goku going to high school infuriates me? It's like, I kept thinking maybe this part of the show is where they got the inspiration or, I guess, justification for, you know, doing that type of scenario for the movie where Goku's going to high school and whatnot. And think, oh, well, you know, Gohan went to high school, so people won't mind this. You know, it'll be the same type of thing, except, you know, Chi-Chi is Videl and Gohan is Goku in this case, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I don't know, maybe there's some correlation there. I don't know. What do you guys think? And just something that crossed my mind when I was looking at those episodes before. And keep up the good work. I'm loving these longer episodes because it's good material to work with while I'm animating. And I look forward to the next episode. Later.
Thank you, Kerberfer. Yeah, I don't think really whether Goku is in high school or not, I don't really think this movie looks salvageable.
You know, the one quote I keep reading in a lot of these review sites is just that it looks low budget. And I have to echo that sentiment every time I look at it. It looks more like network movie than a big budget feature film. And I think it was Topless Robot I was on yesterday. They were talking about the new English trailer. The author of the article said, I've just run out of hate. I can't hate on this thing anymore because I've just basically given up. We all know what it's going to be. We all know what to expect going into it. I for one, I think I'm going to skip this one, and you know, maybe I'll check it out on DVD or Blu-ray later on just for shits and giggles to be able to talk smack about it on the podcast, but I'm certainly not excited about it.
Yeah, and I'm just bitter because they didn't hire me to do the narration. If I were on it, I think it'd be the greatest movie ever made.
But I guess you also clarified the rumor that Chris Sabat is also not involved with it either.
He is not. A lot of people were saying he was going to be voicing Shenron in the movie, and I managed to see him over the Christmas break. I recorded on a lot of shows and a lot of bit parts over the Christmas break at Funimation, and sure enough, there he was in the hallway, and I said, hey, it's great to see you, man. So, what's the truth? Are you really in this Dragon Ball movie? He goes, nah, dude, no one's ever contacted me about that. No, there is absolutely no connection with the English dub actors or Funimation, for that matter.
Or apparently any connection to the anime or the manga, so, hey.
Out of the name and a couple of characters, but that's about it. Well, let's move on to another MP3 who comes from Eduardo. Lots of news here. Let's check it out.
Hey there again, Kylie Bear and Audible Steve at the Big Bomb Broadcast. I'm Eduardo Aguirre, a.k.a. Sayed Mexican, dropping in some MP3 feedback once again. First off, hope you guys had a good Christmas and holiday season. That goes out to all the listeners as well. And hope that the new year is going well for everyone thus far. Kyle, you know I love what you do and how you do it, so keep that up, but this time I gotta give props to Audible Steve. As you know, I did buy your album, Primer of the Void, and I liked what I heard, so much so that if you drop another album, I'll be sure to pick it up. But on to business, I love the recent quick hits segment of the show, so I thought I'd contribute some news I found to be strange, random, or ridiculous, much like the absurd otakus wanting to marry anime characters, in the same fashion. So now I present to you Quick Shots. Ever wanted to have your own Gundam? Well, now you can, but it will cost you $742 million to be exact. Just when you thought movie adaptations couldn't get any more weird, bad, or ridiculous, well, now there is a movie in the works for Monopoly. That's right, the board game of all things. DDR is getting a musical. Weird. Red vs. Blue is getting an anime series done by the same company that did the original series. You can find a camera shot preview up on YouTube if you do the search. The original series itself is hilarious, so I do recommend you check it out. And lastly, the Full Metal Alchemist OVAs are finally getting dubbed. Recently they just got licensed, and they should be available in stores pretty soon, so keep an eye out for that. Alright, well, I hope you enjoyed Quick Shots, and at the least I hope it was entertaining. And I'll catch you guys later. Peace.
Thank you very much, Eduardo. That's a lot of news that we did not actually cover, even on our Twitter page at twitter.com/BBBroadcast. But yeah, the Red versus Blue anime, I want to see some official footage. Unfortunately, it's just camcorder footage taken at PAX 2008, but it's kind of cool to see those guys venture off into something outside the machinima genre there.
I love Red versus Blue. I've gone on and on in earlier podcasts about it. It's some funny shit. If they can bring that humor over to that anime genre, I'm in for that, definitely.
Monopoly movie, not so excited about. DDR musical, yeah, but more FMA, yeah, no problems there. That's all I can say.
No, I mean, that's one thing that really gets my juices flowing. I've kind of fallen off the anime thing. I can't keep up with it. There's nothing really interesting out there. FMA is kind of the dark night of the anime universe. It set the bar so high that it's really hard to find other properties that equate to it. And, man, I can't wait for some concrete news out of Japan from when this second series is going to get running. And hopefully Funimation will get the distribution rights for that and dub that. I'm just, whew, I get goosebumps all up and down.
Yeah, it might actually motivate me to finish watching the first series.
That's just absolutely disgusting, all right? You want me to be serious about a topic? That's just disgusting, okay? You disgust me.
I watched the first half. I watched the first 26.
That's nothing. The second half is the culmination. It's when the plot just gets really hectic and you get all these epiphanies. It's crazy. So, you know, I say we don't even podcast next week so you can just sit down in front of your TV and dedicate some serious time to rounding out FMA.
It's bad enough I have to catch up with Galactica, and I'm telling everyone not to tell me who the frackin' last Cylon is. It's like, well, I bought the new box set, and I've got 10 episodes to watch. I know you don't care about Galactica, but, yeah. Yeah, but
even I know who the last Cylon is.
Ah, yeah, well. Okay, well, our last email, it's a long one, so pardon us, but this comes from PG Sun, who has written us many times before on the podcast. Looks like he has a slight bone to pick, Steve, so let's give him some air here. Unfortunately, it's not an MP3 comment, so I'll have to read this. Minor correction I would like to point out for some of Steve's comments. Spider-Man 2 is pretty universally, with some exceptions, heralded as a better film than its predecessor by both critics and most fans alike. I have seen only a few comments from fans otherwise, but it's very rare. It also was, by the way, the highest grossing film under Titanic until Spidey 3 beat it out, which of course was then wiped out by first Iron Man, then blown into oblivion by Dark Knight. It wasn't subpar, though, and I think personal opinion of it being so isn't making it a fact. The reason for such a turnout for 3 wasn't just because people wanted to give the franchise another chance or something after the second film's lackluster return. It was because fans loved the second and were that much expecting that the third film would be just as good, if not better. Oh, and Venom in it, of course. On that note, Sam Raimi spoke to my school, the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California, a couple of terms ago. Besides being such an honest, humble guy and offering up the best advice from any guest speaker yet to our school, in my opinion, he also stated the reason the third film was so convoluted was the studio. On the first two films, the studio allowed him to do whatever he wanted, something that's rare and even surprised him. However, for some strange reason, when the time for the third picture came by, they basically pressured him to include all the cut stuff from the first two films in this one. Like, what if we had this now? Let's put this. We want it in two in here, etc. He didn't want to have Venom in this one with the other two villains, nor all of the emo drama, etc. So, you can chalk the deflating of the Spider-Man series to the poor decision by the studio to basically take the decision process away from Raimi. Second point is on yet another statement in similar fashion about Batman Begins. Heralded by critics as one of, if not the, best film of that year, it also had Oscar buzz and also did great at the box office to jog some memories. It also was thought on by most fans as the best adaptation yet of Batman, as well as one of the best comic book films ever made. You think the hype over The Dark Knight was so just because of Ledger and the trailers themselves? No. That only boosted it into the stratosphere. The moment Nolan and Bale were on board for a sequel, people were buzzed to see it. It would have smashed the box office even if we didn't see the outstanding trailers we got, or even if Ledger hadn't passed away. To say it did okay and only was okay logistically is just not accurate. Too much personal opinion, laugh out loud, and that's my opinion on the matter. Just bear in mind that the figures of movie grossings, others' fans' views, and critical acclaim history for movies or any other media material being discussed should be stated accurately, and then I think it's fine to give your opinion on a thing. It just skews the viewer's view to your own by withholding some of the facts on things. So, I guess this is as much a comment as a suggestion/feedback. Good show, though. I wouldn't keep listening if it weren't. P.S. I also love Swamp Thing, even if the sequels were okay. I really like the TV series, too.
I would like to remind all of our listeners, and also in particular the individual providing that feedback, that when I made those comments, the majority of that just rolled off my tongue, and the majority of that is just my personal opinion, my perception of the films. I don't think I stated it as fact, although I also must admit I didn't go back and listen to my comments to verify that either, so it's all subjective. Reviews and the box office gross and whatever, it's all still very subjective. It's your personal opinion on how you feel when you walk out of the theater after watching that particular film. For example, Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. I don't know anybody who would proclaim it as a great film, and I'm a big Star Wars fan. I remember seeing the very first Star Wars, Episode 4, in the drive-in theater in 1977. I grew up with Star Wars as part of my life, as well as part of my home decor. But, you know, Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, worldwide, to date, has grossed $924 million. It's almost $1 billion. That's huge numbers, both with the box office and DVD sales. But would I consider it a great movie? No. Titanic, highest grossing feature film of all time. You couldn't pay my way to see that movie. I have no interest in it whatsoever. But it's, again, the highest grossing film of all time. Does it make it a great movie, in my opinion? No. So again, it's all highly subjective. When I say that Batman Begins was all right, that's my opinion that it was all right. It wasn't anything great. Was it great compared to what Tim Burton offered? Was it great to all the prequels? Of course. It was a great reboot. I guess I went into it with too high of expectations. It was a good film. Again, I wouldn't call it great. The thing that concerned me about The Dark Knight is before the movie came out, so many people, their whole drive to see the film was because of Heath Ledger's passing. They're like, oh, I gotta check it out, Ledger's last role, blah, blah, blah. That did generate a lot of the buzz for people to go out and see the film. Was the reason everybody went out and saw the film? No, of course people wanted to see how they were going to follow up with Batman Begins. That's where my curiosity lied. But you have to admit, Ledger's passing did play a part in how the movie was received. And that's why there's all this huge buzz that, oh, Ledger's going to get the Oscar for Joker, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, he was great as the Joker in the movie. Would I say hands down Oscar-worthy he needs to get at Best Supporting Actor? Probably not. Again, that's my opinion. Most of what I say is my personal opinion. If it came off as me stating fact, I do apologize for that. But one thing I will never apologize for is voicing my opinion. So, that's all, baby.
Yeah, we rarely actually have anything beyond our show prep open in a window on our laptops here when we record the show. So, again, exactly quote box office figures and all that. But we are glad, nonetheless, that you are a continued supporter of the broadcast, as anybody who is downloading and checking out our show and telling their friends about it. We definitely appreciate that. And, of course, welcome differing points of view. You are, of course, entitled to your opinion, just as we are as well. So remember, you can send those opinions, whether it's an email or an MP3, and even submit news, just like Eduardo did. If you didn't already see it on our Twitter page at twitter.com/BB Broadcast, where there are daily updates to geeky news there. So send your thoughts, suggestions, feedback to thebigballbroadcast@gmail.com.
And I do have one other statement that I have to make. My apologies for not getting it in earlier. But I was thinking about this. I had read the comment, the email feedback comment, and then I went to the grocery store, and this was just going around in my head. In particular, the part about why Spider-Man 3 sucks so bad, and with Raimi losing a lot of control over the film and the studio asserting that it go in certain directions. For a fan of Spider-Man, and I've been a Spider-Man fan for over 30 years, even for the casual moviegoer who just goes to the theater just to check it out, justifying why a movie's shitty doesn't make the movie any better. It's still a shitty movie. When somebody goes in and watches the movie, I don't think in the back of the head they're going, well, yeah, you gotta understand Raimi lost control over where he wanted to go, blah, blah, blah. No, when you watch the final product, and if it sucks, you got every right to turn around and say, that movie sucked. I don't care why it sucked, but after watching it, I want my $8.50 back because that movie sucked. So Raimi and the studio can defend it until the cows come home about why it sucked. It doesn't change my opinion of that movie one bit.
Let's move into the quick hit category, where we've got some news that are short and sweet and geek-worthy. April 4th is the rumored release date for Nintendo DSi. That's right, the brand spanking new DS handheld console for a whopping price of $179.99. Yep, that's $50 more than the cost of a current DS. Here's the funny part. They don't consider this new DSi to be a replacement. It did launch in Japan in November, featuring a larger display screen, dual 0.3-megapixel digital camera, SD card support, and internal storage, though it drops the port for Game Boy Advance carts. Boo.
Bad. George Lucas has signed off on Star Wars, A Musical Journey, a 2-hour live musical event featuring a Stormtrooper kick line and singing Wookiees with John Williams' Oscar-winning score. Premiering next year in London's O2 Arena, the production will be performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in sync with the movie clips from the 6 live-action films. The show will play in chronological order from The Phantom Menace to Return of the Jedi.
Now, you know, this may not even top the Star Wars Christmas album with that classic, "What do you buy a Wookiee when he already owns a comb?" Emily Blunt is apparently the front runner for the part of Natasha Romanoff. We were discussing this on our last show, a.k.a. Black Cat for Iron Man 2. Blunt's credits include The Devil Wears Prada, The Jane Austen Book Club, Charlie Wilson's War, and the upcoming Wolfman for Universal. She would be joining new cast members Don Cheadle, Mickey Rourke, and Sam Rockwell.
And wow, that little App Store side project Apple's been going on about sure doesn't seem to be settling down. After launching in July of 2008 and hitting 100 million downloads in September, the App Store has just crossed the 500 million download mark, a mere 6 months after opening. Compare that to iTunes Music Store, which took 2 whole years to cross the 500 million mark. Though to be fair, we have little idea of the paid-to-free ratio of apps downloaded. There are over 15,000 apps on the App Store currently, and sure, 14,500 of them are crap, with the rest being tip calculators, but we've got to hand it to Apple for pretty much unprecedented success in the mobile download space. Now, let us download some SNES emulators.
Amen! Jackie Chan is close to signing for the role of Mr. Miyagi in an upcoming remake of The Karate Kid. Will Smith, James Lasseter, and Ken Stovitz's Overbrook Entertainment is producing this remake, along with the original film's producer, Jerry Weintraub. The setting will be relocated from the U.S. to China. Chris Murphy has been attached to pen the screenplay.
According to IGN's latest Nintendo Voice Chat podcast, the developers of the title discovered that it was possible to access the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection without them and built a custom engine that did so. IGN's access to well-placed sources is unimpeachable, so there's no reason not to seriously doubt this claim. Right now, the game in question is unnamed and possibly still unannounced. Joystick independently confirmed that it wasn't the conduit. And our money would probably be on an Electronic Arts title, since they've got a better track record for building their own online infrastructure for consoles than almost any other publisher right now. Either way, this is news to get excited about, assuming Nintendo doesn't stop the publication of the game or force in friends codes. One third-party publisher pulling off online multiplayer free on the friends code systems means others are going to follow. This is a much-needed shot in the arm for the Wii's appeal to the hardcore crowd.
Yeah, my Wii still gathers dust.
You know, it's really ironic because I actually was playing the Wii today for the first time in a long time. I actually popped in a Super Smash Bros. Brawl and realized how far along I still have to go in that game. So, for the next few days anyway, I'll be playing the Wii.
Facebook kills the Burger King app. We reported on our last show that there was this excellent cross-promotion going on where you had to delete 10 friends and you would get a free Whopper from Burger King. Turns out 233,906 friends were removed by over 80,000 people in less than a week. Insanely awesome promotion, pure genius. However, Facebook pulled the plug, citing privacy issues. Apparently, the user was notified when a friend dropped them in order to help score the free burger. They didn't like that. Not one bit. Massive blunder? Yeah. How did this get approved only to be yanked a few days after launch?
It was absolutely brilliant. It had my full support, and I'm kind of sad to see it go by the wayside.
Well, at least well over 230,000 people are getting a free burger.
Hopefully, unless it turns into another Dr. Pepper fiasco.
All right, let's get into the meat of the podcast. We got lots of content to cover, so thank you for checking us out. Watchmen back on track for March release. Huge news. If you haven't been following it, there was a lawsuit. Now there's not anymore. Fox was claiming distribution rights, and looks like Fox and Warner Brothers have decided to play nice. Here is an official statement from both studios. Quote, Warner Brothers and 20th Century Fox have resolved their dispute regarding the rights to the upcoming motion picture Watchmen in a confidential settlement. Warner Brothers acknowledges that Fox acted in good faith in bringing its claims, which were asserted prior to the start of principal photography. Fox acknowledges that Warner Brothers acted in good faith in defending against those claims. Warner Brothers and Fox, like all Watchmen fans, look forward with great anticipation to this film's March 6th release in theaters. Terms of the agreement will not be disclosed, but it is said to involve a sizable cash payment to Fox and a percentage of the film's box office. Fox will not be a co-distributor of the film, nor will it own a piece of the Watchmen property going forward. So I believe, Steve, you said that was your prediction for the outcome.
Yeah, I said that, you know, Fox just really needed their palms greased and everything would go fine. I think what was holding it up was just the negotiating of how much grease had to go into their palm before they gave the okay. And, you know, there's some speculation right now that the upfront cost could be upwards of $200 million.
And some skeptics will tell you that, yeah, while the hardcore comic fans are geeking out over Watchmen and will see it opening weekend, what about the mainstream moviegoer? Are they going to want to see an almost 3-hour long movie featuring comic book heroes they've never heard of?
A lot of people have said from day one, this has cult hit written all over it. It might do poorly at the box office, like most cult classics. Stands a real good chance of rebounding once it comes out on DVD and Blu-ray. What's really interesting right now is that Fox's other big film on the slate is Wolverine Origins, and that film is currently going through massive reshooting in Vancouver right now. And there's that's pretty common for a film to do some reshooting before its release. But the speculation is because they are getting so much cash from Warner Brothers that they're parlaying that into the Wolverine film to kind of bring it up to par. So I think that news is pretty interesting coming on the heels of the Watchmen news.
And something that I know will never come out as a DVD extra is just an alternative cut. I mean, yes, we got the Richard Donner cut of Superman 2, which is drastically different than the theatrical cut. And it's a great chance for fans to see how completely different visions can take a film. So yeah, I'm wondering what Wolverine X-Men Origins would be as is without the reshoots, and will the reshoots actually help or hinder the movie?
Well, there's been a lot of rumors online, actually some of it stated as fact, about how horribly the initial shoot went. There's a lot of infighting and just a lot of issues with the production, so I know some reshoots were warranted. But again, you know, if you can bring a couple $100 million into the production to make it kind of smooth sailing, yeah, you know, I guess it worked out for you and I, the casual moviegoer.
Not only do we have that update about The Watchmen, we've got a massive update regarding the Cowboy Bebop movie. Steve, take it away.
Some of this you may already know, but sprinkled in this is some new news. Keanu Reeves will top line 20th Century Fox big screen adaptation of the very popular Cowboy Bebop series. The relatively unknown screenwriter, Peter Craig, is attached to pen the adaptation with Sunrise Inc., which is the original anime producers, and they'll be working closely with Fox on the adaptation. Sunrise's Kenji Uchida and Sinshiro Watanabe, who is really cool dude who Kyle and I both got to meet. They're going to serve as associate producers alongside series writer Kiko Nombuto. Now, Irwin Stoff will be producing, and Joshua Long has been named executive producer, and they're still talking about the script being based on the anime's first episode, Asteroid Blues, concerning the red-eye drug, which speeds up the perception of the user. So a little bit more detail there regarding the Cowboy Bebop live-action adaptation.
But it's still Keanu. Oh.
But at the same time, I think it's really positive to know that, you know, you've got the original producers on board, working closely with Fox on the adaptation. You've got the series writer and the character designers on board. To me, that's really, really positive. And I hope that if they're very tightly involved with the adaptation of the film, it just might be pretty kick-ass.
Well, one can hope. I mean, Keanu has been in some good movies before. I mean, you can always say that the guy can't act his way out of a paper bag, but that the character, you know, I just like, can he really milk the persona that is Spike Spiegel? I mean, can he really pull it out of his ass? Because that's going to be a challenge, I think.
Well, you know, this is my personal take on it. I have spoken to many a voice actor, and I'm sure you can certainly lend your opinion to this, Kyle. When a voice actor goes in to perform a role, you're relying primarily on the direction given to you by the director. If the director says he wants a character portrayed a certain way, then you, as the talent, give the director what he wants, and you perform it in that certain way. So, again, if you're bringing the people from the studio, the original Japanese production company, involved, and they are very serious about how this film's translated, and they have a certain direction for the character, hopefully Keanu, as an actor, can follow that direction and give them exactly what they're looking for.
Yeah, and hopefully it's just not like another Tom Cruise situation where he really makes all the calls behind the camera.
The Japanese have a lot riding on this. I think that, you know, with anime being like the new hip genre in Hollywood, that if they can pull this off successfully, it's really going to open the floodgates for more anime-based films. For it to be taken seriously as a genre, initially the superhero franchises weren't taken seriously as a genre. They were kind of silly and slapstick, and, you know, again, the early Batman films are certainly a testament to that. If this can come across very serious, very dedicated, we might actually see some good anime films coming out.
Now, I will admit that given what we've seen of Dragon Ball, I am excited just on principle about a Cowboy Bebop film. Not necessarily Keanu, though. I'm still really sketchy about that. I still argue, though, that anime should probably just remain what it is. When it goes live action, I think something gets lost in the translation.
I read a really great article last night, and unfortunately I don't have the time or the memory to go back and pull it up and read it verbatim. But one of the key notes they really hit on was, yes, anime is drawn, and anime is primarily known for ridiculous hair and ridiculously large swords, much like the Final Fantasy series. If you take an anime and you do a serious film about it, and you drop the ridiculous hair and the ridiculously long swords, you kind of have, you know, a subpar translation because it doesn't bring those elements from the anime to the big screen, so you're kind of missing the punch. When you introduce the ridiculous hair and the really long swords, it does come off as being really campy and kind of corny. So, yeah, I guess to a certain degree with the anime genre, there's just no way to win.
Not really, because you think of the way Spike Spiegel looks with that massive fro, and then you imagine that photoshopped on an image of Keanu Reeves, and yeah, that doesn't look so hot.
Yeah, the guy's walking around with green hair, for God's sake, you know?
I could see him in the outfit with the cigarette dangling out of his mouth and just, you know, talking all smooth. But, you know, to me, Steve Bloom's pipes, man.
And the thing I said from day one, and I'll continue to say it until it comes out, I won't get excited about this film one way or the other until I know who they're going to cast in the role of Faye Valentine.
And it can't be Angelina Jolie.
No. But let's face it. Boobies sell tickets.
Yes, they do. Boobies sell movies.
That should be like the new Hollywood tagline. I want a bumper sticker for my car that says that.
Yeah, it all comes down to the mighty dollar sign, which apparently is a big deal over in the Sam Jackson camp. He says negotiations with Marvel have broken down regarding his role as Nick Fury in Iron Man 2 and the subsequent upcoming Avengers live-action movie. Oh. That's good.
That was Sam Jackson worthy.
That's, yeah, dude. Marvel still says they want him. And now apparently director Jon Favreau had the same situation a while back when his contract was being drawn up and fan support basically allowed Favreau carte blanche. So then again, you've already seen Terrence Howard walk because of money, but I could say that Terrence Howard ain't no Sam Jackson.
To me, this sounds very reminiscent of the whole Warner Brothers Fox fiasco with Watchmen. It sounds like it's a negotiation that's coming down to money, and I guess it depends on how much of Nick Fury they were anticipating on showing. I know they just talked a couple weeks ago about expanding the role, having a lot more Nick Fury involved in the second Iron Man movie. And of course, you know, again, the whole purpose behind an Iron Man movie is the culmination with the two big Avengers movies, which, of course, Nick Fury is going to have a substantial part in. I could see Sam Jackson pulling a little FU, saying, you know, if you don't line my pockets a little bit more, I'm not going to be a part of it. Does it sound like a bluff? Oh, hell yeah. Because you'd be kind of stupid to pass up a role in this franchise. You're not talking about one film. You're talking about that being a franchise character. So, you know, this is going to go, again, behind a closed-door negotiation. It says the agent's going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, and the studio's going to keep pushing back. And I think in the end, we're still going to see Sam Jackson in that role.
I mean, let's turn back the clock a little bit. Wasn't this his whole idea in the first place? Didn't he push to be Nick Fury?
He did. And I found it ironic how quickly Marvel was to jump with the animated Avengers movies to portray Nick Fury as a black man. I think that they took his suggestion very seriously and said, okay, we're going to revision the series and we're going to introduce Nick Fury as an African-American, and in the hopes, anyway, of having this character portrayed on the big screen as another black man, Sam Jackson. So at least Marvel's already committed to the race change. I think, you know, no matter who they cast, it's going to be a black man in the role. I think Sam Jackson certainly brings that clout to it, that name recognition, that star recognition. And again, I think it's something that's going to be negotiated, and in the end, you're still going to see him there. He's just probably going to demand a bigger piece of the pie for it.
Kind of makes me think of the older situation with independent films when you got big names. In fact, I'm thinking of a particular example of Reservoir Dogs, the first Quentin Tarantino movie. He wanted Harvey Keitel. Harvey Keitel usually demands a little bit more of an actor's fee, but he took a substantial drop in pay because he believed in the story. He loved the screenplay and wanted to be in the film. The same thing happened on Pulp Fiction with Bruce Willis. I mean, these actors, big-name actors, who are rich beyond the dreams of avarice, they don't need the paycheck. They just want to be on that property. I would think that since this is Sam Jackson's idea in the first place, maybe he would, you know, since he's supposedly just kind of an everyman sort of person, you know, all the reports are he's not really the celebrity type. He's actually just a normal guy that I think he would, you know, only use his clout as far as to get the role. It's not really necessarily about the money. The man's rich, you know?
Well, it just sounds to me that he's got Marvel backed into a corner where they've been so committed over the last few years to have him portray this character. This isn't certainly new news or anything earth-shattering that Sam Jackson's going to play Nick Fury. Who knows? Maybe it's his agent. I've heard of, you know, the most sweet and innocent actors and actresses with the most honest of intentions, and you just have this real shiesty agent who's going to push and push and push because the agent's job is to, you know, get them their role and negotiate the fee, and they get a percentage from that. So certainly the agent's best interest to push as hard as possible. Jackson's being kind of, you know, tight-lipped about the whole thing. He's not going to go into detail and shoot himself in the foot in case something opens up in the future. So we don't know all the details, but from what we've gleaned, it's certainly coming down to the almighty dollar. I guess it depends on how serious Marvel is right now, how committed they are to keep him attached to the property.
Marvel has made so much money with Iron Man and to a much lesser degree the Hulk to kind of line their pockets and really set their whole Marvel Universe franchises in motion. They move their base of operations, you know, they're still in LA, but they're on Manhattan Beach, which is prime beach property. It's not cheap to live there. So if they're going to move their studios there to produce as a hub for all these films, you can't say that, oh, we're nickel and diming because we just don't have the money. Guys, they got it.
Maybe this is another case of the aching economy. Maybe Marvel's afraid that with these big budget movies on the slate, people just won't have that disposable income to go see this movie theatrically and then to buy the Blu-ray or the DVD later and all the associated merchandise. So maybe they're trying to trim down their production budgets a little bit, try to streamline things a little bit, and hope to recoup their money on the final project. And when you got people that are demanding big bucks for the role, maybe you just gotta cut where you gotta cut. Now, the interesting thing about the first movie is the rumor anyway is Terrence Howard was the highest paid actor on the call sheet for that entire film. He made more than Robert Downey Jr. With the success of the first Iron Man movie, maybe, you know, Robert Downey Jr. demanded more money, and right now we couldn't see Marvel recasting the lead role in Iron Man, so maybe they had to fork more money over to him and said, well, you know, we just don't have that money in the casting budget right now for a more minor character in the franchise, and, you know, offered him a smaller slice of the pie, and he got a little pissy about that. I don't know. This is just speculation. In the end, I will say I'm pretty confident things will pan out with Sam Jackson in the role. For the second mention of Star Wars in this podcast, I got some news about some Star Wars DVDs coming to a galaxy near you. Four of the most popular episodes from the hit animated series Star Wars The Clone Wars will come to DVD from Warner Home Video and Lucasfilm Limited on Tuesday, March 24th. The release of Star Wars The Clone Wars, A Galaxy Divided, marks the very first time the weekly adventures from Lucasfilm Animation have been made available on the format. The hit weekly animated series debuted this fall on Cartoon Network. It's the first TV series from Lucasfilm Animation that chronicles the adventures of Anakin Skywalker, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Yoda, Ahsoka Tano, and other favorite Star Wars characters as they struggle against the dark side during the diverse, action-packed Clone Wars. Star Wars The Clone Wars A Galaxy Divided has a $19.98 suggested retail price and showcases four episodes: Ambush, Rising Malevolence, Shadow of Malevolence, and Destroy Malevolence. For fans eager to own the entire first season of Star Wars The Clone Wars, Lucasfilm is in the midst of producing a multi-disc box set that is expected to debut later in 2009. Full details of the first season DVD box set, which is also planned to mark the first Blu-ray appearance of the series, will be announced later this year. The collection will include substantial bonus material that is currently in production at Lucasfilm, including explorations of behind-the-scenes creations of the hit series.
Now, I could just jump on this and go, yeah, I haven't watched any of the Clone Wars stuff yet and get this, but I'm a completist. I gotta have the collection, so I'm gonna hold out for the season box set.
It's really not a bad series. Unfortunately, it's only been because of my time constraints that I haven't been able to keep up with it regularly. You know, I've said it before and I'll say it again. At the end of the day, it's Star Wars. It's still new Star Wars stuff for the fans. I mean, granted, it's events that take place in between the feature films, but it's still Obi-Wan and Anakin and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's still, you know, gets me excited to see these things on the small screen. And I'm actually pretty excited to know that a Blu-ray release is coming. That's going to be the first Blu-ray release of a Star Wars property. So that's really exciting. And it also gives me hope that one day we'll get to see the feature film box set on Blu-ray.
I want the holiday special on Blu-ray.
Don't we all?
To see Carrie Fisher all coked up and Mark Hamill wearing so much makeup, his face is going to fall off.
And Harrison Ford just really showing you he didn't want to be there.
Really phoning in a performance, more so than even on Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
And B. Arthur. I mean, shit, what Star Wars without B. Arthur, you know?
Now, if a lot of our listeners are just shaking their heads going, why do they keep talking about this holiday special? I implore you to go seek it out. I'm sure there's some, at least segments of it on YouTube, if not the whole thing. Unfortunately, there's not a good version available to the public. Everything is third or fourth generation VHS at best.
And ironically enough, the anniversary, the 30th anniversary just passed recently, and the official Star Wars site, StarWars.com, did a tribute to the special. So you can actually go over to StarWars.com and read a lot about the history and kind of the pains regarding this, that show in particular. And to this date, 30 years later, Lucasfilm still has no intentions of ever releasing this monstrosity to the public.
Oh, the pain. Yeah, it is. It's pretty hard to sit through, admittedly.
Let's see, again, you got B. Arthur running the cantina, going into the song and dance routine. You've got this segment with Jefferson Starship that's just absolutely disturbing. The only positive thing that I think that came out of the Star Wars special, it was actually, and a lot of people may not know this, but it was actually the origin or the first appearance of Boba Fett. Boba Fett actually appeared in an animated segment prior to The Empire Strikes Back, so it's actually the first appearance of Boba Fett ever in the Star Wars universe, and it's really funny because it's so out of character from the other films that have Boba Fett in it, but that part is pretty interesting anyway, so even if you can just find the animated segment on YouTube, that is worth a watch. The rest of it you can just blow over.
In the video game department, there are a lot of factors that influence gamers as far as why to buy a game. Maybe your friend buys one. Maybe you've read a good review online. Maybe you're into first-person shooters. Is it the gore? Is it the boobies? Is it the violence? Is that the real motivating factor behind gamers' decisions to buy a game or not?
Well, the next time a loved one brandishes a virtual shotgun in their favorite video game, take heart. That look of glee, says a new study, likely stems from the hearty pleasure of mastering a challenge rather than from a disturbing craving for carnage. Research published online January 16th in the Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin shows that, contrary to popular belief, violence does not make video games more enjoyable. The study by investigators from the University of Rochester and Immersive Inc., a player experience research firm, found that for many people, gore actually detracts from a game's fun factor, decreasing players' interest and desire to purchase a game. When designing the next generation of video games, added the author, developers should remember, blood does not help the bottom line. For the vast majority of players, even those who regularly play and enjoy violent games, violence was not a plus, explained Andrew Przybski, a university graduate student and lead author on the study. Violent content was only preferred by a small subgroup of people that generally report being more aggressive. However, even these hostile players did not report increased pleasure when playing more gruesome games. Through 2 online surveys and 4 experimental studies, the researchers showed that the people stayed glued to gaming mainly for the feeling of a challenge and autonomy they experienced while playing. Both seasoned video gamers and novices preferred games where they could conquer obstacles, feel effective, and have lots of choices about their strategies and actions. These elements, say co-author Richard Ryan, a motivational psychologist at the university, represents, quote, the core reason that people find games so entertaining and compelling. Conflict and war are a common and powerful context for providing these experiences, but it is the need of satisfaction in the gameplay that matters more than the violent content itself.
If the game is fun, the game is fun, and that's what's going to really sell it for me. I don't have any prerequisites. It doesn't have to be blood and gore. Now, I own a good fair share of mature-themed games. I have Resident Evil, got Gears of War, Left 4 Dead. That's one of my favorite games right now, just because it's just addictive and just over-the-top bloody mess. But I'm not going to say that that is the reason why I get these games.
I would have to agree. With me, it's, as a steady state, it's the challenge. It's getting to the end of the level, getting to the end of the game, achieving certain objectives. The blood level, the violence level, certainly, for me anyway, isn't an indication of whether or not I'm going to pick up the game. I have just as much fun playing Tetris as I do playing, say, Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, I remember there was a point in the gaming industry when it was kind of taboo to be over-the-top violent, and that whole Mortal Kombat thing was, ooh, that was cutting edge.
It was, but nowadays, and I think most gamers would agree, it's pretty passé. We've seen developers get really in-depth with the storytelling and really selling the franchise that way, because just the novelty of having some blood and guts, it isn't a seller anymore. It isn't like, ooh, making headline news and being talked about on the 11 o'clock news. So while we're getting more sophisticated gameplay, and yeah, I mean, the graphical representation is more realistic, I certainly don't think that it's a selling point for the majority of gamers out there.
Not really. I can fire up an old school classic like Galaga or Dig Dug and get into it just as much as Uno or Left 4 Dead or Resident Evil. You know, it just doesn't matter. You know, I just want something that's fun.
I echo that. I literally can go from my 360 or my PS3 over to my Dragon's Lair cabinet and still have that youthful enthusiasm playing a video game. And it's not about the sex either, that's for sure. You had that BMXXX game that came out, and that was an absolute utter failure. And people are, you know, talk about some of the scenes in the new Grand Theft Auto with going to the strip club. It's not explicitly graphic nudity, so, you know, I don't think sex sells a game either. I think it's the depth of the gameplay and how intriguing it is for the game player.
And then there's other cultures like Japan where you have hentai games and, you know, porn-based, like, dating sims and such. I'd like to know the sales figures on those.
Well, you know, everything that I read about online, Japan certainly seems like a very perverted society. So I can see that going over in their society. But again, you know, I'm glad you brought it up, because conversely, we don't have it as openly available here, so I don't know if that's a matter of the supply not meeting the demand, or if the demand just doesn't really exist so highly here.
You've got even the porn industry saying, we need a financial bailout. I was laughing, and I thought it was actually a gag, like an Onion-type post, but apparently it was true. Like, Larry Flint and the guy from Girls Gone Wild want to actually ask the government for a financial bailout for the porn industry. It's like, oh, come on!
I don't think it has anything to do with the current economic situation. I think it has a lot more to do with the internet and the availability of, you know, terabytes of free pornography available to anybody. I don't think it has anything to do with people not wanting to go out and buy it, because, shit, you know, we've got piracy and every other genre out there. If you can get it for free, people, I think, are going to kind of be skewed to go that way.
Yeah, and so far, the next-gen consoles have been able to kind of keep the whole internet phenomenon and piracy at bay, at least enough. You know, the sales figures are still very strong for video games, by and large. So, that part's good. But what are the top-selling video games of the year? Gears of War was up there. You know, Call of Duty. I mean, these are very gory games, actually.
I don't think this article denies that people are playing gory games. I think the point they really wanted to drive home is people aren't playing them for the gore factor. People are playing them because they're very involved intricate, compelling games, and you just want to make it to that next level, that next checkpoint to finish the game. And the level of gore isn't the purchasing factor. I think if you were to tone down or even eliminate a majority of the gore in these games, you'd probably still see those high sale numbers because they're good games.
And that goes back to the basic principle that Nintendo's holding for its Wii console is, we don't care about the graphics, we care about the gameplay.
Right, again, Nintendo is basically the main reason the game industry is still afloat. And after looking at the tens of millions of consoles that they've sold, both the home consoles and in the handheld market, I mean, what they're saying is certainly true. And I think it's also a testament to the number of casual gamers out there, the moms and the grandmoms, who just want to pick up a game, play it for a little bit, and put it down and not worry about, you know, did I get all the items in that level? Did I get to that save point or that checkpoint? Same with the mobile phone industry with the games. A lot of them are just, you know, for the casual gamers. And when you see 500 million apps downloaded from the Apple Store, you know, again, it certainly backs up the criteria in the article.
And it's got to be ADD-type games for a mobile phone, of course, because, you know, think about it. This is a mobile device. You can't get something that's going to get like a 10-hour-plus RPG, and you're sitting there squinting your eyes over your cell phone the whole time.
Yet. I always love using the operative word yet, because, you know, who knows? That just may be the wave of the future.
Oh, crazy, crazy. You know, speaking of cell phones, let's talk about this. The National Safety Council wants cell phone use while driving banned. Now, of course, sure, there's plenty of states right now that can fine you for yakking on your cell phone while you're driving. And some have even begun ticketing drivers for texting. I know that's true in California beginning January 1st. They're starting to fine people for texting while driving, which makes sense. Yeah, it's very, very dangerous. The National Safety Council is calling for an all-out nationwide ban on this practice. What's more is the group also says that laws that allow for hands-free cell phone use are giving people a placebo, quote, and that they don't, in fact, make calling while driving any safer. The group also seems to be taking particular aim at businesses, saying that calling while driving can increase costs and even open up employers to liability. Now, this ban includes even the use of hands-free or Bluetooth headsets. Now, for me, I think that's overkill. I'm fine if they want to, you know, if they want to ticket you for holding the phone to your ear. Of course, that distracts you from driving. I get that. And texting, I'm totally guilty of texting while driving. I'm completely guilty. Is it wrong? Yes, you should not text while driving, obviously. You could take this to the ridiculous level. You know, where are they going to stop it? Are they going to start fining people for having a conversation with other people in the car or eating or putting on makeup or listening to the radio? I mean, there's a gazillion distractions while driving. And no matter how many precautions one takes behind the wheel, the only person you have control over in the end is yourself.
I actually, I agree with the sentiment behind it, but I also have to echo what you just said because that was the thought in my mind. This is an issue that's been going on long before the advent of cell phone use. Every day when I go to work, I see people smoking and drinking their coffee and eating and reading the newspaper or looking at directions. There's always been distractions when it comes to being behind the wheel in an automobile. I'm a pretty good example for that, where I put my head through my windshield because I hit a parked car while trying to get a spider off my windshield. That was enough of a distraction for me to take my eyes off the road for 2 seconds and not notice I was swerving. So there are plenty of distractions that exist. Granted, we live in a democratic society. We do have rights and free will. When it comes to being on the road, it's not just you at risk. It's everybody around you you're putting at risk when you allow yourself to become distracted in these things. I would like to see people get ticketed for being distracted, reading the newspaper, putting on makeup, eating, drinking, things of the like. Because, again, it doesn't have to be my fault to get killed in a car accident. I can be the most attentive, most aware driver on the road. But if the person in the lane next to me is applying their makeup while they're smoking and they get their large mocha grande in their hand and they swerve over into my lane, you know, that's enough to take my life. So I do think that our government has to be more proactive and acknowledge that the issue of drivers being distracted needs to be attended to and not just the use of cell phones while driving.
Right. And now I was reading this article on Engadget, and I look in the comments section. This person brought up a good point. The fines are relatively low in the United States. I know here in California, your first offense for driving while holding a phone up to your head is probably like $30-$40. And over in the UK, it could be up to $2,000. So I'm thinking $40, that's a drop in the bucket. You know, if a speeding ticket, if you're going like 2 or 3 miles over the speeding limit and it's $300, it sounds a little off kilter.
It does. The only way you're going to get people to stop doing it is to give them the ouch factor. you get a $500 ticket for driving while talking on your cell phone, you're going to go, ouch, that really hurt my pocketbook. I'm not going to do that again. For $40, yeah, I'll be a repeat offender easily.
Every person is different as far as their ability to multitask. I have been using Bluetooth headsets for years, probably like the past 5, 6, 7 years. I've never had a problem. I enjoy using Bluetooth. I don't like holding the phone up to my head because my arm gets tired. And again, it is very dangerous, and I accept that when you're behind the wheel, it could block your field of vision if you're holding your arm up and all that sort of thing.
I'm a big fan of the Mythbusters over on the Discovery Channel, and they actually tackled this a couple of years ago where they did a study. They had them drive a course unimpaired and then drive a course while using a cell phone, and the conclusion they came to was that there's really not much of a difference between somebody driving while operating a cell phone and somebody who's driving drunk. And that just really blew my mind that it was that much of a distraction for somebody on the road. So, you know, after seeing that, and again, with my own personal accident being distracted, I do think it's a good idea to attempt to curb it to the best of our ability. Will it stop it? Absolutely not. But I think people do need to be a lot more aware of when they're on the road.
They do. And I also wonder if the internet generation is becoming more ADD and becoming somewhat a little bit better at multitasking. Say, for example, you're sitting at your laptop, your PC, and you're chatting with 10 different people on Instant Messenger, and you got your MySpace page open, and you're checking the internet, and you're reading an RSS feed over here, and you're downloading a podcast. You're doing all that, and meanwhile, your TV's on, and you're flipping channels. You're doing 50 different things, literally, and yet you're paying attention to all of them.
That's a good point. I think the other issue, too, is that you have a lot of youngsters just getting their permit or their driver's license, and they still have that umbilical cord, be it the cell phone or whatever. It certainly proves to be a pretty big distraction. There was that commuter train accident a while back where the commuter trains actually collided with each other and people were killed. And at the end of the investigation, they acknowledged that one of the conductors was texting while operating the train, and that's what led to the accident. So it's certainly a very real-life scenario that these types of situations do occur. And again, I am in support of a program like this nationwide, as long as the ouch factor is attached to it. Because again, if it's $40, yeah, you're going to pull me over 3 or 4 times a week for doing it.
And have you noticed just watching just regular people, as nearly, you know, 4 out of 5 people, as they're walking down the street, are paying attention to their cell phones, they're texting, or they're listening to their iPod or whatever, and they're not watching where they're going, and they walk straight on into traffic at the intersection.
As much as you and I on a weekly basis praise the technology we surround ourselves from, it does make it very impersonal. We're all kind of enclosed in our own little bubble, and we're not really aware of our surroundings and our environment. So I don't know. I mean, it's part of our culture. It's part of our blessing and part of our curse, and it's going to take quite a long time before we can really acknowledge the real impact to our society regarding it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if the whole call for cell phone bans won't kind of trickle over into something involving pedestrians where, you know, you're forced to, or else you risk getting fined. If you're going to walk into traffic, and what if you cause an accident because you're sitting there trying to text your friend as you step head on across the street?
I got pulled over for speeding a couple months ago. The police officer asked me, you know, well, why were you speeding? And I said, well, to be honest with you, I just wasn't paying attention. And he goes, well, yeah, no shit. I saw you talking on the cell phone. That's why you weren't paying attention. So another real life example. While I didn't get ticketed for using the cell phone, it was just an issue of me speeding because we don't have that type of enforcement where I live. But it kind of opened my eyes a little bit to go, yeah, that was enough of a distraction for me to not obey the speed limit. And as a result, I got a speeding ticket. So, yeah. I'm the driving worst-case scenario for all these topics we're discussing.
Nice. Now, I did see an example about a month ago. I saw a policeman driving down the street holding his cell phone to his ear while driving, and that just pissed me off.
That's when you need to take a picture and upload it to your Flickr page.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think fast enough. So let's talk about Circuit City. You know, they're saying goodbye. Now, before, they were just closing a few stores here and there, but now things are getting really, really serious for these guys.
Yes, Circuit City Inc. has announced this week that it will seek bankruptcy court approval to begin the process to liquidate the assets of the company. We are extremely disappointed by this outcome. The company has been in continuous negotiations regarding a going concern transaction. Regrettably, for more than 30,000 employees of Circuit City and their loyal customers, we were unable to reach an agreement with our creditors and lenders to structure an ongoing transaction in the limited time frame available. And so this is the only possible path for our company, says James A. Macrum, Vice Chairman and Acting President and Chief Executive Officer for Circuit City Stores, Inc. Circuit City will provide more details in the near term about the plans for the liquidation of the stores and other assets, the status of the company's website and FireDog SM service operations, the status of its Canadian operations, and the plans for the company's bankruptcy proceedings. The company does not anticipate any value will remain from the bankruptcy estate for the holders of the company's common equity, although this will be determined in the continuing bankruptcy proceedings. So, long story short, no more Circuit City and 30,000 employees facing the unemployment line.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier in the podcast, about the state of the economy and all these corporations making major cuts left and right. Clear Channel, as far as radio, they're just dropping 1,500 people. Sony has dropped thousands worldwide in their corporate entity. So, it's just depressing.
Microsoft, for the first time in over a decade, big layoffs. The Arena League football is just on hiatus until further notice. The economy's impact in all areas is pretty extreme. For a major retailer like Circuit City to close all of its stores, liquidate all its assets, and lay off all its employees, that's pretty touching.
There's still arena football?
Well, you know, the people who can't make the NFL cut need something to do in their free time. But thing with Circuit City, I think that, you know, they'd be struggling regardless of the state of the economy because they're up against the other big box retailer, Best Buy. And Best Buy is so entrenched in the nation right now. They're basically the tech answer to Walmart. I think they would have seen these struggles regardless. But, you know, I think the state of the economy has kind of sped up the procedure a little bit. And I guess it's kind of given Best Buy carte blanche with all their tech needs.
It really is. You'll see exclusives with DVD releases. You'll see bands release their albums only at Best Buy. Sometimes it totally backfires, like Guns N' Roses. And then it works to the advantage of AC/DC, who went with Walmart, and they're like made like $65 million, I think, over the past year.
And speaking of working to the advantage of, it's hoping, you know, even given this dismal economic situation, we can still go out and pick up a nice flat screen TV relatively cheap with Circuit City's liquidation.
Now, my prediction is you're not going to necessarily get the Black Friday sort of bargains, but this is a really good opportunity for people who were thinking, you know, I want to get that HD TV for $500, 52-inch or something. And I don't know that the savings will be like really, really like that well. But the thing to be aware of is that, of course, because the store is closing, they're not going to offer the extended warranty, which normally I think that whole extended warranty thing is a ripoff. But if you're going to buy a big ticket item like an HD TV, that's an investment. That's something that needs to last you, you know, the next 5 to 10 years. And I'm a big advocate for actually purchasing an extended warranty because the manufacturer's warranty is only going to cover the first year. What are you going to do after that?
I think if you can get it piss cheap, it really doesn't matter. That's just me, but
well, maybe not. Maybe you shouldn't bitch. Okay.
And, you know, especially given Sony's dismal performance over the holiday season, maybe now would be the time to go out and pick up a PS3.
Well, there are rumors about a price cut coming in April, so hold out a little longer just in case. Our final item before the top 10 list of the show is downloads coming to YouTube. Now, sure, there have been some workarounds for downloading YouTube vids, but for Joe Q users, simplicity is king, and it looks like downloads are coming. At least there's an indicator, because as of now, you can get President Obama's weekly address as an MP4 file. There's a little click-to-download link underneath the streaming video window. Pretty cool. Now, the uphill battle, of course, is copyright issues, and you know, how do you track ads and keep track of all the downloads? But the potential's there, obviously, to help spread the word about YouTube like it needs it, you know, to more users, more devices, and even those without an internet connection.
I think it's pretty cool, although there's been some unscrupulous ways to do that for a while. I've been able to download YouTube videos for probably well over a year, although I don't find it all that practical because a lot of what's on YouTube is crap anyway. But I think it's pretty interesting to make those files available and have you store them up on your hard drive space, which, again, I don't understand, because if you've got it streaming for free, then why even waste your hard drive space on it? I don't know. I guess you'd have to find a pretty some pretty interesting content worthy of download, because I don't see a need to download anything from YouTube.
Yeah, that's true. But then again, for people who don't have the internet and you want to show somebody, I guess you could burn that content to a DVD or a CD and show them.
I guess you could. I guess that would probably be the only exception.
Because a lot of DVD players can read data disk now, so...
I guess if you really have to have it on your cell phone to watch it anytime, anywhere...
All right, time to close out our episode of the Big Ball Broadcast with another top 10 list. This one actually doesn't come from Cracked.com. This one is actually from Spike.com. It is the top 10 worst video games based on movies. Number 10, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now, part of the reason this game sucked was that it was on the Atari 2600. I get it. Don't bother commenting about that. But I ask you to consider this. Atari 2600 was also responsible for the egg that hatched the entire gaming universe, Pong. Pong was off the hizzy, and Raiders of the Lost Ark, by comparison, was totally on the hizzy. Nobody wants to be on the hizzy.
Number 9, Friday the 13th. This game is universally reviled for a variety of reasons, and it would be number 1 if it weren't so obvious. That's like saying Michael Jordan was the greatest basketball player of all time. True enough, but not that interesting. Friday the 13th failed for many reasons, but the principal one is that in this horror game, there is very little horror. You don't get to play as Jason, and even when you see him, he's in broad daylight and moving slowly. Weak.
Number 8, Shrek 2. Yes, it was for the GameCube, and I'm aware that maybe a 20-something dude that plays and replays Crackdown isn't the target audience, but seriously, I actually like Shrek, the movie. There was enough in there to enjoy, even for a cynical old SOB like me, but... this game wrung the tongue-in-cheek out and focused solely on the blind dollar harvesting that made me hate Shrek 2 and Shrek 3, the movies, so much. For shame, Shrek. You make a terrible Ogre King.
Number 7, Jaws Unleashed. Jaws was, and is, effing terrifying, and every boy is obsessed with, and an expert on, sharks. This seems like an automatic home run, but, to be perfectly frank, I'm not exaggerating when I say that I'd rather be eaten alive by a great white shark than be forced to play this game from beginning to end. Jaws Unleashed is hard to control, not ridiculous enough to be funny, and fun for about only 10 minutes.
Number 6, Star Wars Bounty Hunter. Like Shrek, Star Wars has been strip-mined beyond anything my furtive mind could have possibly imagined, and it can imagine some pretty crazy shit. For that reason, I hated Star Wars Bounty Hunter. However, it ultimately falls into video game hell because of its crucifixion of super badass Jango Fett, aka the Fett Man. He's hard to control, not very deadly, and only looks okay. He's the exact opposite of everything an interstellar bounty hunter should be, and this game is the exact opposite of awesome.
Number 5, Ghostbusters 2. Repetitive levels, unscary baddies, and a jaw-clenchingly high difficulty for what could have been a completely rad Ghostbusters game. This game should have been melted with a proton pack and sucked into their containment tank along with Gozer, Zool, and the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Number 4 on our top 10 list of the worst video games based on movies, Enter the Matrix. It was another one of these games that looks really good on paper. Too bad the video games are played on televisions, though. The Wachowski brothers are brilliant, and they decided to fill in the plot between the first and second of their Matrix movies with a video game. Not a bad idea, sirs. However, they focused too much on the storytelling and not enough on the game. The cinematics were great, and so was the story, but the game was so unplayable, I never got to see the entire thing.
Number 3, The Blues Brothers. The Blues Brothers is definitely in my top 5 movies of all time, so this one hits pretty close to home. In this game, you play the Blues Brothers, and it's pretty awesome. But why it failed is it lacked the best part about the Blues Brothers, the music. Also, the Blues Brothers didn't look like the Blues Brothers, and instead of running from the cops and Nazis, they run from, like, bear trap things. Surely, John Belushi is rolling around in his grave.
Number 2, Iron Man. Iron Man was the second best movie of last year and had all the potential to be a completely face-melting game. Mostly, it could have been awesome because you get to be friggin' Iron Man! I had such high hopes. Then they came crashing down like Robert Downey Jr. at 7 a.m. in the Hollywood Hills. The clunky gameplay and infuriatingly difficult enemies made this game playable for about half an hour, which is not even close to enough time to truly battle worldwide evil and corporate greed. You need like 3 hours minimum.
And the number one worst game based on a movie? Street Fighter, the movie.
Oh, wake me up when this is over.
Street Fighter 2 revolutionized fighting games, and it'd be hard to fill the enormous shoes left in the Street Fighter franchise. Other titles have done alright, but Street Fighter, the movie video game failed so epically, it actually made me like Street Fighter 2 less. It's like hating somebody because their grandkid is kind of a dick.
And that concludes our podcast. Thank you again so much for downloading and checking us out. Remember, spread the good word to all your friends and family. And, of course, check daily updates on our Twitter page at twitter.com/BBBroadcast. Coming up, Maria will tell you the various ways to get in touch with the show, so please consider doing so. We'd love to hear your inputs and feedback or story submissions or whatnot. So until next time, this is Kyle Hebert.
And this is Otherworld Steve.
See ya!
Catch up on all our past episodes at www.bigballbroadcast.blogspot.com. You can also subscribe for free via iTunes to have new episodes downloaded automatically. Send your MP3 comments and emails to thebigbaldbroadcast@gmail.com. Get daily updates and links to all the geeky stories you hear, plus lots more at twitter.com/BBBroadcast. Donations graciously appreciated and accepted via PayPal on our blog page. Transmission complete.